Demonology and Medicine. The scientific study of the human body and its diseases has had to contend, and to some extent still has to contend, with a mass of superstition, supported until modern times by the whole weight of ecclesiastical authority. Disease was sometimes a divine visitation in punishment of sin, but more often the work of demons. It could be cured by the intervention of saints, either in person or through their holy relics, by prayer and pilgrimages, or, when due to demons, by exorcism and by treatment which the demons, and the patient, found disgusting. We now know that certain kinds of diseases can be cured by faith, while others cannot. No doubt miracles of healing do occur, but in an unscientific atmosphere legends soon magnify the truth and obliterate the distinction between the hysterical diseases which can be cured in this way and the others which demand a treatment based upon pathology. Plagues and pestilences, which were common and terrible in the Middle Ages, were attributed sometimes to demons, sometimes to the wrath of God. A method of averting God's anger, which was much recommended by the clergy, was the gift of lands to the church. In 1680, when the plague raged at Rome, it was ascertained that this was due to the anger of Saint Sebastian, who had been duly neglected. A monument was raised to him, and the plague ceased. The Black Death in 1348 caused outbreaks of superstition of various sorts in various places. One of the favourite methods of appeasing God's anger was the destruction of Jews. In Bavaria, 12,000 are reckoned to have been killed. In Strasbourg, 2,000 were burnt. And so on. Not only were superstitious methods of combating disease universally believed to be effective, but the scientific study of medicine was severely discouraged. Anatomy was considered wicked, both because it might interfere with the resurrection of the body, and because the church abhorred the shedding of blood. Dissection was virtually forbidden. Pope Pius V, in the latter half of the 16th century, renewed earlier decrees by ordering physicians first to call in the priest, on the ground that bodily infirmity frequently arises from sin, and to refuse further treatment if the patient did not confess to the priest within 3 days. Perhaps he was wise in view of the backward condition of medicine in those days. Theological prejudices reappear when awakened by any startling novelty. Inoculation against smallpox aroused a storm of protest from the church. Many Scottish ministers joined in a manifesto saying the inoculation was endeavouring to baffle a divine judgment. So late as 1885, when there was a severe outbreak of smallpox in Montreal, the Catholic part of the population resisted vaccination, with the support of their clergy. However, the effect in diminishing the death rate from smallpox was so notable that theological terrors have failed to outweigh fear of the disease. The treatment of mental disorders, as may be imagined, was peculiarly superstitious, and remained so longer than any other branch of medicine. Insanity was regarded as due to diabolical possession. Sometimes a cure could be effected by exorcism, or by touching a relic, or by a holy person's command to the demon to come forth. Sometimes elements which savour of magic were mixed with religion. It came to be thought that the best way to drive out the evil spirit was to torture it, or to humiliate its pride, since pride was the source of Satan's fall. Foul odours were used, and disgusting substances. The formula of exorcism became longer and longer, more and more filled with obscenities. By such means, the Jesuits of Vienna, in 1583, cast out 12,652 devils. When, however, such mild methods failed, the patient was scourged. If the demon still refused to leave him, he was tortured. For centuries, innumerable helpless lunatics were thus given over to the cruelty of their barbarous jailers. Even when the superstitious beliefs by which cruelty had originally been inspired were no longer accepted, the tradition survived that the insane should be treated harshly. The harm that theology has done is not to create cruel impulses, but to give them the sanction of what professes to be a lofty ethic, and to confer an apparently sacred character upon practices which have come down from more ignorant and barbarous ages. The intervention of theology in medical questions is not yet at an end. Opinions on such subjects as birth control and the legal permission of abortion are still influenced by biblical texts and ecclesiastical decrees. See, for instance, the encyclical on marriage issued a few years ago by the Pope. Those who practice birth control, he says, sin against nature and commit a deed which is shameful and intrinsically vicious. As regards the interruption of pregnancy for medical reasons, that is, when it is considered necessary in order to save the woman's life, he states, "What could ever be a sufficient reason for excusing in any way the direct murder of the innocent? Thou shalt not kill." It is difficult to resist the conclusion that, to many men, there is something enjoyable in the sufferings of women, and that, therefore, there is a propensity in men to cling to any theological or ethical code which makes it a woman's duty to suffer. Although, as we have just seen, theology still tries to interfere in medicine, over most of the field the battle for the scientific independence of medicine has been won. No one now thinks it impious to avoid pestilences and epidemics by sanitation and hygiene, and though some still maintain that diseases are sent by God, they do not argue that it is therefore impious to try to avoid them. The consequent improvement in health and increase of longevity is one of the most remarkable and admirable characteristics of our age. Even if science had done nothing else for human happiness, it would deserve our gratitude on this account.